Elton, how are you?
I'm well. We hope you are.
Yes, sir. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes if I could.
Okay, you have the 5 minutes.
Your Honors, again, my name is Ed Spivey, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant. This is an appeal from a decision of the majority of the Virginia Workers' Compensation Commission, Commissioner Marshall dissenting, denying the claim of my client, Orthopedic and Spine Center, for underpaid charges for medical services rendered to an employee injured on the job and covered by the Virginia Workers' Compensation Act. In that case, there was no issue that the injuries were causally related to the workplace injury. There was no issue that my client's bills for services rendered complied with the prevailing community rate. What this case boiled down to was whether or not the appellees were entitled to a contractual discount for the services rendered by my client. And we submit that the commission majority erred for three alternative reasons. First, and the court need look no further than the articulate dissenting opinion of Commissioner Marshall for this ground, the commission majority ceded to a lay witness the court's authority and obligation to interpret the terms of a written contract and then failed to account for what that lay witness actually testified. The lay witness, of course, was Ms. Maureen Sample, a representative of Coventry Healthcare, and the conclusory, uncorroborated testimony in question concerned the existence or not, and applicability or not, of a written contract allegedly entitling the appellees to discounts afforded in 2002 by my client to a company called First Health Group Corp. As the proponent of a defense grounded in that contract, the appellees bore the burden of proving that it applied. And the appellees failed utterly to adduce proof of that fact. They did not introduce into evidence at the hearing below at all the written contract allegedly linking them to the benefits.
I mean, the written contract is always nice, but as we know, the commission has more relaxed rules of evidence. And so, why isn't I understand your point that the verbal testimony didn't get them there either.
Correct.
But given the latitude we give the commission in interpreting its own rules and the fact they're more relaxed on the rules than the regular rules of evidence, wouldn't it be imprudent to require someone to produce this written contract?
Your Honor, I don't believe it would be imprudent, nor do I believe that it is proper under these circumstances, where certainly there has to be credible evidence of the written contractual linkage, to disallow the need for that testimony. And we're not reliant, as Judge McCullough, you recognize, on the best evidence rule. Clearly, in a court of law, the best evidence rule would have required submission of the writing upon which the appellees relied. Even at the commission level, the substantial rights of the parties are not to be infringed. And when, in a case like this, you have a written contract that allegedly exists, to not introduce evidence of it, at least some evidence of it, some corroborating documentary evidence of it, I believe infringed on the substantial rights of my client. But as you point out, our argument in this regard does not even rely on those points, because the evidence that the appellees did introduce, the testimony of Ms. Maureen Sample, contraindicated the finding that there was any contractual linkage here. What Ms. Sample testified to, and this is at Joint Appendix page 94, was that at the time in question in 2007, when these services were rendered, the contractual tie between Sedgwick, one of the appellees, and First Health Group Corp. had been replaced by a contract between Sedgwick and Concentra Focus, a different PPO network administrator. Not even the appellees contended, much less adduced evidence below, that my client OSC had ever entered into a contract with Concentra Focus. So we believe that on legal grounds, more evidence was required, but beyond that, the evidence that was introduced and that was relied on by the deputy commissioner below, when scrutinized, actually contradicts the position of the appellees below. And we believe that on those bases, this first alternative basis of error applies.
And there's no dispute, right, that OSC, or one of the doctors anyway, had an agreement with First Health. So really, the key link that you say is missing is between Sedgwick availing itself of these discounts.
That's right, Your Honor.
Via First Health.
Because when you read that orthopedic and spine center contract with First Health, you will not see Sedgwick anywhere named in it. You will not see Keystone Automotive anywhere named in it. And so in order to avail them, what you will see in that contract, and it's clearly spelled out, is the anticipation that First Health Group Corp would, via written contracts, avail others, payors, of the discounts afforded in that contract. And so the precise terms of the very OSC First Health Group Corp contract anticipates additional written contracts, and yet it is that additional written contract that was nowhere introduced into evidence under at the proceedings below. Now, we believe that there is yet a second alternative basis upon which the decision below should be reversed, and that is grounded in the doctrine of waiver. We believe that the appellees clearly waived any right they may have once had, which, again, we don't believe there was evidence of, to rely on that First Health OSC contract. And this goes back to a document that's very important in this case, the explanation of review. It's at Joint Appendix page 3. It's a one-page document. It's real-time evidence. It was furnished by the appellees to my client back in 2007 at the time the underpayment was furnished. And what you will see on that explanation review is a clear indication of the contractual discount upon which the appellees were relying. It is the Aetna Workers' Comp Access AWCA network discount that is expressed and elected by that explanation of review. What you will not see on that explanation of review is any mention of First Health Group Corp, the party with whom my client had entered into a contract to afford discounts. You will not see a reference to First Health Group Corp on that explanation review, and that is very important. You will also not see any reservation by the appellees of a right to rely on any alternative basis of discount.
So I'm sorry to take you back to your first argument. There are two under, and I'm looking at page 138 of the appendix, and specifically paragraph 2.7 that defines payor.
Yes, sir.
So you have two basic ways you can be a payor. One is the second sentence, any other entity which has contracted with First Health to use First Health's PPO plan. So as to that, there would need to be evidence that this entity has contracted with First Health to use First Health's PPO plan. What about this first sentence? I mean, we have an employer, Keystone, or an insurance carrier, and they have an obligation to provide medical services or benefits for such services to participating patients, and then that's separately defined. What's your argument as to why that first part of that particular paragraph does not apply?
Judge McCullough, let me start in answering your question by referring you back to one other provision that precedes the one you're focused on, paragraph 1.5, because obviously we read contracts as a whole, and I think paragraph 1.5 is important to this analysis. In paragraph 1.5, it says in the second sentence, provider further understands that First Health will offer to certain payors, the opportunity to contract with First Health to utilize the services of the healthcare providers participating in the preferred provider panel. Then, we have a reference to the opportunity to contract with First Health. Then, when you go to paragraph 2.7, the agreement you're referring to, the way I read that definition is that everything that comes before it is modified by which has contracted with First Health to use the First Health's PPO plan. So, in other words, it's a payor means an employer, for example, which has contracted.
In other words, you're going to get these discounts. That's fine. We'll agree to that. But we're not opening the barn door to everybody to get these discounts. It has to be a prior.
Exactly, Your Honor. And in fact, the Virginia Supreme Court, and we cited this case in our brief, has spoken before to this concept of who's an intended third-party beneficiary. You don't open the floodgates to the world, and all anyone has to do is come in and say, I'm a payor. I get your discounts. No, it is more restricted. In order to be an intended third-party beneficiary, you have to look to the terms of that
and
contract.
And I threw you off your stride, and I see you're in your rebuttal, so it's... Anyway, I just thought of it.
Well, let me just briefly say we believe, as to that second ground waiver, that the Virginia Supreme Court has spoken specifically to the kinds of circumstances we have here in Stockbridge versus Gemini Air Cargo. We believe that case is directly on point and demonstrates a waiver. And then third, and briefly, if Your Honors get to the First Health contract, which again, we submit you shouldn't, because first, it wasn't proven, and second, it was waived. We believe that the express terms of the contract, as admitted to, again, by the witness upon whom the appellees relied, Ms. Sample, shows that a retroactive denial is what the appellees are seeking, and that is prohibited by the express terms of the contract. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Ms. Alcorn?
Good morning.
Good morning.
And while we're on the topic, my interpretation of that provision that you cited in regards to the definition is, in fact, that there are two separate clauses for a payer. The medical provider's interpretation would require this court to add a comma, and it's just not in that provision. If it was to be construed as one type, only those that contracted, it would require us to add a comma. I believe also that when you look at paragraph 1.5, what the medical provider fails to consider is the very first sentence that just says the provider agrees to participate in the PPO plan. One of the other things that's important to understand about this particular case is that this First Health agreement is not just workers' comp. It's indemnity programs, insurance, HMO, group health plans. So some of the provisions in this particular contract don't pertain to workers' comp. And one of those provisions has been cited by the medical provider in regards to this retroactive denial. And they're citing to a specific provision of the Virginia Code dealing with ethics and fairness and carrier business practices. By the very definitions of that code section, it doesn't apply to workers' compensation claims. It's important to understand the scope of this agreement, and the scope of it being beyond workers' comp can be found in paragraph 2.3 on page 138 of the joint appendix. And that indicates health plans. And that lists the different plans that are controlled by this contract, meaning indemnity plans, HMOs, insurance group health plans, and workers' compensation plans. While this particular contract does incorporate by reference the ethics and fairness and carrier business practices, there's no indication that either of the parties wanted that reference to be expanded from group health to include workers' comp. And I think that that's addressed by the full commission in the sense that the medical provider failed to prove that the that First South Coventry or the payer, Sedgwick in this case, breached the contract by not expanding that to include workers' compensation. But backtracking just a little bit, I think that we've got some preliminary matters that I just want to address very quickly. There's been some argument before this court regarding Illinois law and how that would impact this particular case. That wasn't argued before, and we would move to exclude that, and we would object to any consideration of that that wasn't argued below, and it's not properly before the court at this point.
I mean, the Commissioner Marshall alludes to that in passing, but he doesn't really develop the point in his dissenting opinion. I mean, he doesn't cite the provisions, he doesn't walk through it, he just makes a casual reference to it, and that's the extent of it.
Correct, and I think that that just mirrors the fact that it wasn't argued by the parties, and it wasn't properly before even the full commission. Second kind of preliminary point, latches, there's been some argument about whether or not that particular defense is still viable. It's Sedgwick's position that the deputy commissioner didn't address latches and that the full commission specifically articulated that they weren't going to address that particular issue. So we don't believe that that's properly before the court either. At the beginning of the argument for the medical provider, there were some references to the commission's discretions to develop their own rules, and I believe that there are two particular rules that are at issue in this case. The first being that pursuant to Rule 1.8G, anytime a party wants to depose anyone other than a physician, they have to get leave of court or leave of the commission to do so. And in this case, the defendants or Sedgwick and the employer actually requested and were granted leave to depose both Maureen Sample and Barbara Zero. And the reason that that's important is in order to get that leave of the commission, a reason for the deposition has to be articulated. So while the medical provider can argue that their rights are impacted or that there's some sort of unfairness in regards to how this case procedurally advanced, I think it's important to note that, one, the defendants had to request leave to take the deposition of Maureen Sample, and it was actually taken prior to the evidentiary hearing. At no time did the medical provider object to the testimony that came in from Maureen Sample, either in the deposition or at the hearing or at the full commission level, other than to say, we don't think any weight should be attributed to her testimony.
Counsel, can I stop you a minute and ask you, the point of retroactive denial, is that a legal issue? Did the commission make it a legal holding, or is it a factual finding?
I think it's both in regards to the full commission. I think that in regards to does Maureen Sample have the ability to make a legal opinion regarding whether or not the facts in this case are a retroactive denial, I think the commission has said no. But I think that they've also made reference to the fact that based on the code section, the 38.2-3407, they had a fact or a legal finding that that didn't apply to a workers' compensation, and an additional finding that the medical provider failed to prove that that was somehow breached in regards to this particular case.
So what's the standard of review for this court?
The standard of review in regards to the determination of that issue, this court is not bound by the full commission's legal ruling related to whether or not that particular section applies. But again, I think they are bound by the factual findings in regards to what's before that. And I think talking about factual findings, the standard really before this court is whether there's credible evidence to support the commission's finding. It's not whether or not that there was no other evidence or it could have gone a different way, because clearly the record reflects that there was some weighing of the evidence. And I think that Commissioner Newman went through the points and accurately reflected the evidence and weighed the evidence. I think that it's improper for the court to look at that particular issue as a legal matter. And I think that specifically the commission found several things. First, there was a factual finding that Coventry bought First Health and its PPO assets in January of 2005. Further found that Coventry acquired Concentra Focus in 2007, and that was based on the testimony from Ms. Sample, and that can be found at Joint Appendix 64, in which Ms. Sample, quote, says, Coventry acquired First Health Group Corp. and its PPO network in 2005. Further, at Joint Appendix 62, when it says Coventry Healthcare acquired the assets of Concentra Focus, and Joint Appendix 73, where Ms. Samples explained that the portion of Concentra that Coventry acquired was the Focus network and the clients who accessed the Focus network. Another factual finding that the commission cited was that the provider had an agreement with First Health and that Sedgwick had access to the First Health Workers' Comp network of providers. Specifically, the references to that include Joint Appendix 63, where Maureen Sample testifies that the participating provider agreement is between Martin R. Coleman and First Health Group Corp., which is a company that was acquired by Coventry in January 2005. Joint Appendix 68, lines 17 through 20, question, did Sedgwick, the third-party administrator in this case, have access to the First Health Comp Workers' Comp Network? Answer, yes, they did. Joint Appendix 93, starting at page 23. Question, Sedgwick was a member of the First Health's client network. Is that correct? Or is that right? Answer, correct. Sedgwick is, and Sedgwick was also a client of Concentra for some time period. I think one of the things that's gotten lost in this is that Sedgwick had a relationship with both First Health Group Corp. and Concentra. So either avenue gets us back to the same point, which is Sedgwick had access to the First Health network of providers, which included Dr. Coleman. Furthermore, the Maureen Sample explained that Sedgwick was a client of First Health in multiple pages throughout her testimony, or multiple sites throughout her testimony. She specifically said that there was a written contract between First Health Group Corp. and Sedgwick. She acknowledged that she herself had seen it, but it had been a while. Again, this is important because at no time was there an objection to this. At no time, either during the deposition or at the hearing, was there an objection that said it should be produced. I think it's improper at this point, after there's a negative ruling, for the medical provider to say, no, none of that testimony should have been considered at all, and really it should have been, the best evidence rule should have been in play. Moving on, there were some additional factual circumstances of this case that are really undisputed, is that OSC sent the bill to Sedgwick. Sedgwick sent the bill to Coventry to be reviewed. Coventry then told Sedgwick what to pay, and that's undisputed. One of the confusing elements of this case is that in real time, there were multiple contracts that this provider had entered into, and that's not unheard of. Frankly, most medical providers enter into various contracts, whether it's Aetna, Anthem, any of the other PPOs, and it makes sense because the purpose of these contracts is to increase revenue and marketability in exchange for reduced reimbursement rates. And again, these contracts, both the Aetna contract and the First Health contract, are not limited to workers' comp. They're broader group health HMO plans. So with that in mind, the medical provider really has always gotten bang for their buck in regards to additional revenue and marketability.
When there's other contractual provisions, like you have to pay within a certain period of time, et cetera. So at least in theory, it's not going to be dragged out. I'm not sure how much in reality that bears out, but that's the theory.
Correct. And this is a complicated scenario. This is not the first time that this particular, it's the first time this issue has been before the court, but there have been other kind of iterations of the same problem. And really just the backstory to that is that this provider had various PPO agreements and that Coventry had access to those various agreements, either through their corporate acquisition, in this case First Health, or through their business partnership with Aetna. So in this particular case, in real time, when the bill was processed. It was originally processed pursuant to hierarchy. So by the agreement of all the parties, the Aetna contract was ranked primary. So it was originally priced pursuant to that. We now know that there are some issues with that Aetna contract and that this court had interpreted that contract in at least one occasion and with different parties indicated that those parties failed to produce sufficient evidence to establish that that Aetna contract had been expanded to include workers' compensation. Really what we have now is what do we do now? Because this provider had various levels of PPO contract. The provider would like, or is arguing, that we get one bite at the apple. That even though they themselves have contracted and entered into various overlapping networks, that we have one chance and one chance to get it right. But they can't cite any sort of applicable guideline for that proposition. I mean, the reason factually that we have the timeline that we do is because there was some litigation that started in 2011. In those particular cases, and it was in the Mueller-Martini case and a sister case, in those cases, the deputy commissioner and the full commission affirmed the Aetna reductions. One of those cases went up to the Court of Appeals. That's a Mueller-Martini case. And ultimately, there was a reversal that said under a strict contract interpretation review, that particular set of defendants failed to establish that the contract had been properly modified to include workers' compensation. So what that leads us to, from a defense perspective, seeing that binding opinion and reacting to it, is that that opinion came down, that reversal from the Court of Appeals came down in February. That allowed us, from a defense strategy, to reevaluate the evidence and determine whether or not there were any additional defenses to this particular claim. It goes against the fundamental tenets of the legal system that these defendants in this particular case would be barred from presenting evidence because of what someone else did in a different case, especially when the opinion from the Court of Appeals in the Mueller-Martini case did not definitively say under any circumstances they did not include workers' comp, but simply was limited to those parties in that case failed to provide sufficient evidence to establish that it incorporated workers' compensation. In this particular case, when we went forward, first defense, Aetna contract applies. If that doesn't apply, there's this hierarchy of PPOs that the provider had entered into, and the secondary contract, meaning the first health contract, should apply. If neither of those contracts applies, then it's our position that the medical provider's failure to object to the Aetna network reductions in a timely manner prejudiced the defendants because we had other options available to us, and now we're precluding from being able to take that. But again, what's really important about this particular case is that Maureen Sample's testimony, which is really what the medical provider is upset about, occurred with the consent and authorization from the deputy commissioner. It occurred over a week prior to the evidentiary hearing. And even after the evidentiary hearing, the record was left open for an additional deposition. At no time during that did the medical provider object to either the testimony that was taken or that Ms. Sample should testify at all. I don't know if we have any additional questions. I see that my time is running out. Thank you.
Any questions? Questions. Thank you very much for your argument, Mrs. Alford. Ms. Bivey, you had reserved five. You got down to three.
Okay, thank you, Your Honors. It won't surprise you that there's much of what Ms. Alcorn said that I disagree with, but I'd like to focus on just a few things. First and foremost, there's one area I think we do agree with, and that is that this court's decision in Mueller-Martini was a reaffirmation of the importance of the law of contract in Virginia to this precise kind of situation. And I think that becomes the sort of anchor for this panel's decision of this case, and it's very important. And I think, Judge Decker, it renders much of what you're about here a de novo review in response to your question regarding the retroactive denial analysis. That's important because we are not objecting to the testimony of Ms. Sample. It was not incumbent upon us to object to Ms. Sample's testimony. What we're saying is, if you're going to adduce testimony from a witness, as the appellees did here, then you're bound by her testimony under Massey versus Firmstone and a whole lot of cases after it. And what Ms. Sample said here completely disproves the appellee's case. The issue of the Illinois law's intersection with this case is really non-essential to this panel's decision, but it's important because it places in context the importance of the corporate hierarchy here. What Miller-Martini said is you can't just fudge the facts when, as Commissioner Marshall recognized, written contractual agreements are the fundamental building blocks upon which these PPO networks are erected. You got to pay attention to the contracts upon which they're built. And here, it is only through fudging the facts that one could ever conclude that there was an entitlement on the part of these particular appellees to the discounts afforded by that narrow First Health Group Corp. OSC contract. Ms. Alcorn said that whatever avenue you follow, you get there. Well, I submit that that's not right. And even Ms. Sample's testimony illustrates that, because what she honed in on was that the only avenue Sedgwick had available to it in real time in 2007 was one via Concentra Focus. And that avenue, there was no evidence of any contractual linkage of that Concentra Focus with my client. I'm going to conclude my remarks at that point because I see I'm running out of time, but I appreciate your attention.
Counsel, I have a quick question.
Yes, ma'am.
What's your position on applicability of Illinois law and whether you're barred from relying on it?
Well, Your Honor, when Commissioner Marshall mentions it in his opinion, I believe it's important. And like I said, it helps frame the issue, because when you look at that Illinois law, you see why you can't fudge these facts of corporate hierarchy. Illinois law, which was specifically incorporated into the governing contract, the First Health OSC contract, in writing, says that if a PPO network is going to attempt to assign the rights afforded under that kind of contract, it's got to get the consent of the provider, in this case OSC. And there was no evidence of any consent in this case. And so we do believe that in construing the contract on a de novo review, it's important to look at the law that is incorporated into that contract, and that's an issue that is properly before this court, as recognized by Commissioner Marshall. So although we don't believe our argument in any way is dependent upon that, we think it is both helpful in placing this whole issue of corporate hierarchy in context, and it points up the ultimate flaw, one of the flaws in the appellee's argument.
Thank you very much, Mr. Spavy. We'll come down and greet counsel. Then we're going to take a brief recess.